Welcome to Season 5 of the Big Sci-Fi Podcast with Adina, Brian, Chris, and Steve, the biggest sci-fi podcast in the galaxy. The adventure is just beginning here at the Big Sci-Fi Podcast, and we invite you to come aboard the Starship Tangent. We know you'll enjoy the conversation, the laughter, the banter back and forth, and most of all, friends who love hanging out to talk about all things science fiction. Set your phasers to fun. Here we go.
Black holes have been the subject of great study and conjecture in the real world of scientific discovery and theory, as well as in the imaginations of science fiction writers for years. Nothing holds a greater mystery or holds a tighter grip upon our imaginations like black holes do. They have been part of countless sci-fi stories, books, television shows, and films. It's interesting to point out that a country preacher was the first to theorize about the existence of black holes. His name was John Michel. This first mention was in, Are You Sitting Down? 1783. Michel was one of the most brilliant and original scientists of his time. He studied at Cambridge University, where he later taught Hebrew, Greek, mathematics, and geology. He made groundbreaking achievements in measuring the force of magnets, as well as writing a book that helped establish the science of seismology. But we are not here to talk about John. The crew of the Big Sci-Fi Podcast has gathered together this day to talk about the film produced by the Walt Disney Company way back in 1979, the year of my birth, by the way.
Making me feel old.
You're welcome. Called The Black Hole. This film has all the makings of a great and classic sci-fi film. Kinda. It had the potential to stand out and alone in the genre, but it falls short in more way than one, folks. In this week's episode, we'll unpack this grand old flop of a movie and discuss what we love about it, because there are some cool things in it, and what we don't love about it, plenty of those too, and why. Before we get into our banterful discussion, see what I did there instead of wonderful, banterful? Ooh, we'd like to take a minute to recognize and thank our family over at Trek Geeks Podcast Network, of which we're a proud part of. Make sure to check out all the amazing podcasts at trekgeeks.com. And while you're at it, make sure to head over to Trek Long Island's website to register for the second annual Trek Long Island Convention. We're going to be there. The Sci-Fi Sisters will be there as well. Dan and Bill from Trek Geeks.
Ooh.
Join us along with an amazing lineup of actors, podcasters, authors, artists, and more from our beloved Star Trek. Now on with the show, and by on with the show, I mean say hello to our own real-life engineer, the author of the Robot Galaxy series and newly released book Lunar Logic, Adina Mignogna.
Hello, everybody.
You guys can say hey to her, too, if you want to. Jesus.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
All right. Now, shh. Okay. And world-famous YouTuber, at least in our eyes, who has a wonderful YouTube channel you should subscribe to called Yelling About Star Trek. He doesn't really yell all that often, though. Got a bone to pick with you. It's Christian Fox. How you doing?
Hey, everybody. Yeah, I get that a lot, that I don't actually yell that much. In the website, in the YouTube channel.
Maybe you mean the color yelling? I'm sorry.
Oh, what? Okay. He lives in Canada, yelling, by the way. And a gentleman, yes, whose personal favorite Trek is Enterprise, a resident, retired, and all-around nice guy, Mr. Stephen Merkin. How you doing, sir?
It's been a long time. Stop.
Nah,
yes.
Yeah,
good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon.
From there to here.
And you just can't help it, can you? You hear the first part of that song, and no matter what room you're in, if there's a Trekkie, it gets finished. It's like the OH. And if there's an Ohio State person, they say I-O, and it just can't help it.
Oh,
and I'm Pastor Brian Donahue, and I'm just happy to be a part of the swashbuckling crew today. No idea why I use the word swashbuckling in there. We're not talking about pirates. You guys aren't pirates. It must be all
I'm
the
a Dodger
I'm singing in the morning with my son, Brody Tiberius. Anyways, let's go where this movie didn't, shall we? And by that, I mean, let's be entertaining and let's make sure our ending is better than this film's ending. Okay, everybody?
Oh, that's for sure.
So I don't think I put this in the podcast notes, but is this the first time you guys have seen this film preparing for this episode or had you seen it before?
Yes.
First time for Christian. Okay.
I'd seen it before as a kid, but it was not super memorable. Like, I could, you know, the look of it, I could remember kind of something about the look, but nothing about it was truly memorable. So it was almost like I was watching it for the first time.
Okay. Yeah. That's kind of me. I had never seen it. So I'd heard of it and I've seen it on Disney Plus for a long time since that app came around. And so this is my first time. How about you, Steve?
It was a busy December in 1979 because I went to go see Star Trek, the motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, when this came out, I went to go see The Black Hole. And the funny, weird thing was, I have this very strong recollection that I liked The Black Hole better than I did Star Trek, the motion picture. And
really?
I guess I'm going to get baited about later about rose-colored glasses, of course, but I have this, I remember it's like, I liked the action. It was more exciting, you know,
right.
Star Trek. The movie was rather ponderous. So this had a lot more action and stuff. And maybe I was just a younger version of me could enjoy such frivolity as this film has in it.
Did you just use the word frivolity?
Frivolity.
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 An F.
I don't even know what that means.
Frivolous. Like frivolous.
Oh, frivolous. Yeah. I'm not frivolous. Forget about it. Okay. So we kind of got a little bit of Steve's initial feeling. We'll let you go deeper on that if you'd like to, Steve, of course.
Sure.
But let's just go around the Zoom room here. What was your initial feeling as you watched this film?
Oh, my God. And it's never going to end.
Let's do this in two parts here, because this is really for the sake, because we've kind of gone here a little bit. What did you feel about it originally? And as far as the rewatch, did anything change for you? All that stuff.
Well, the only two people that this would apply would be Adina and to myself, because you seem to remember having watched it once. Mm-hmm. I do remember having watched it once. But I'll go open by saying, like I said before, much like some of these films that we see, like Explorers and others, where, you know, I was wearing rose-colored glasses for way too long, thinking about how wonderful the movie was and how great it was. And then you're watching, you're going, I don't quite remember the ending, and holy moly, you know? So that is the problem, is that if it's been so many decades since you've seen something, you might always remember the good times and not the bad. And in this case, even though Trek is a much slower film, again, and we just recently did the same thing where we watched the motion picture. Now watching, going, what was I thinking? The motion picture is a so much better film than this was.
All the way around, a much better film. Adina, what about you?
Well, so like I said, I am certain I saw this, but I have no memory of what I felt about it then, which means, you know, given that I do remember a lot of films from my childhood and this doesn't stick out, it means obviously it did not have there was nothing lasting. But now, and watching it now, I couldn't wait for it to be over. The one bright spot in it for me was the cute robot, of course. The cute, snarky robot. Vincent was that was a highlight for me. And again, the funny thing is the dialogue that Vincent had would have gone over my head as a kid. I would not have, you know, gotten any of it. And now it was like, hey, he's got the best lines in the whole film. I loved it. I loved it. Mm-hmm. Loved Vincent.
Yeah. Played, voiced by Rowdy McDowell, who was in the Planet of the Apes, all sorts. He was in all sorts of stuff, and let alone Disney films. He was all over Disney films in that era. But Chris, how about you? This is the first time seeing it, like myself. What do you think about it? Just generally speaking.
So I have to say this up front, it's not a good movie. I would not claim it's a good movie, but I had a lot of fun with it. I loved the terrible dialogue. for right. one thing. I mm-hmm. love, because we were talking last week about the simple dialogue of Silent Running, and they just took that to the max. It was a lot of, hey, Charlie, what do you think of that thing over there? Oh, that's a little weird. We better investigate it. And I loved it. I liked the dialogue was great. I liked the Captain Nemo-esque Dr. Reinhardt,
right.
which was
yep.
mm-hmm. interesting. Mm-hmm. The mystery was compelling. And I liked how just cheesy it was. Like, it was just... It's one of those movies where I feel like I had heard this was a bad movie. So going into it, I was not expecting something amazing. So I feel like having that mindset and just like, okay, let me watch a cheesy sci-fi movie from the 70s. And I had fun. The ending was weird. We already mentioned the motion picture, and I really just wanted to open up by saying time to impact 20 seconds.
And in real time, 20 seconds.
Order. Yeah.
No. You know,
let's take 2 weeks traveling through V'ger to see where we're going to get in this film. Yes.
You yeah. know what? Let's just switch gears altogether. Let's just talk about the motion yeah. picture yeah. instead of the black.
So one of my problems with the motion picture is you have Captain Kirk, right? I'm just kidding, everybody.
Right. Good. So I watched this film in two parts, but I started it originally months ago with my family. My son and I were the only two intrigued by it. And so we always do pizza night and movie night on Fridays, almost religiously. It's just like our thing as a family. Even if we do something really awesome, our kids get a little upset with us because it's pizza and movie night. You know, they love that time. We love that time. I got to choose the movie. I chose The Black Hole halfway through. My wife and daughter said, we're rebelling against your choice. We're watching something else. So I actually started it all over again and watched it from start to finish the other day. And I'll never get those hour and 48 minutes or whatever back. Now it's interesting.
I was going to say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Brian.
Yeah.
But your daughter and your wife survived the first half of it, which, as Adina says, this is the movie where the first part was rather intriguing, but the second half.
Oh. Yeah. Right. So, it was very disappointing that second half of the film. The first half, I will say, did enough for me to intrigue me. It was slow moving, but it did enough mm-hmm. to intrigue me. The problem with this film, the major problem with it for me, besides some of the special effects that just don't hold up, the matte paintings, stuff like that just clearly obvious in this film, especially interior shots of the ship. The outer space stuff was okay. I don't really have any problems with that. It was the interior of the ship where they clearly had matte paintings and stuff like that. But the second half of the film, just the payoff did not, it just
there was no payoff.
Terrible. Yeah, no. It was just non-existent.
The weirdest thing about the interior of the ship, forget the quality of the, you know, the sets or anything like that, but just the fact that they have like this kind of like early 19th century, like, dining room thing on a spaceship, which is a very odd choice. Because mm-hmm. like, did they launch with that? Where did that, like, I feel like that's a weird thing that they would have launched
way
with.
Up
did
high he... too on Re... top of the
well okay so assuming that ship was the that form factor of the ship, was that room converted later into that? Or I don't know, just that was just such a weird,
yes.
weird choice.
They needed mm-hmm. a dining. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And why didn't it Ships look future? Why didn't it look more futuristic? It was very
right.
homely
why did
looking.
It look like it was from 100 years in the past? You know, like, yeah. It was a very weird choice.
Maybe what you said earlier about Captain Nemo and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And they were going for that look.
Yeah, I think right. so.
Okay.
I think so.
I didn't mean to interrupt
my
you,
only
Chris.
But like, even Trek does that sometimes. Like, the president's office in Star Trek VI, it is all full of 19th century furniture.
No.
But
okay,
again, that's not.
It's on Earth.
Yeah.
Right.
You know. I can. Yeah. I can completely accept keeping something on Earth in the future, kind of, you know, historical, because we do, but in a spaceship away from Earth, that's what's weird.
That part's a little.
I don't know. That's pretty nitpicky when there's so many other worse things to talk
about. He was just mentioning the sets and stuff like that.
I don't know.
Okay. Right.
We were talking, you had asked earlier about the characters.
Yes. Before we get to the characters.
Yeah. So if you want to continue talking about cinematography and all that stuff, that's fine. You want to talk about
I was just looking at that, Steve, because there's a couple interesting things to note here, at least for me, okay? It was one reason I was intrigued by this film originally. Maximilian Schell, who played Dr. Hans Reinhardt, Academy Award winner for Judgment at Nuremberg. He played the defending lawyer? I think he was the defense lawyer for all of the Nazis, which was a heck of a job to have back then. Mm-hmm. So Academy Award winning actor, Robert Forster has been in all kinds of stuff. He was kind of the captain of the ship. He played Tim Allen's dad in Last Man Standing too on that sitcom. Most recently.
Oh, that's cool.
And then of course you have Anthony Perkins, who's famous for what role, Steve?
Psycho. Mommy, are you in the basement? Oh, you need a little more. You need a little more suntan. You've shriveled up, Mom. What's going on here?
Right. And then my favorite character of this film is not the robot, although Vincent is a close second. I loved Harry Booth, Ernest Borgnine's character. Now, here's why I like. They didn't give him a bunch. It was the dialogue, like we discussed, is all pretty simple. But Ernest Borgnine is a master of reaction. If you watch just him on this film, he is acting 100% of the time. The door comes down as he's exploring the ship and snooping around. And the way he responds to it is... it's just brilliant. Like, to me, Ernest Borgnine was the closest to interesting of all the characters. I wanted more. I wish we could have learned. We get like zero backstory about these guys, don't we?
Yep. It started out okay. It started out okay when the movie started, and you've got the guys who are like in charge of the ship, kind of more you've got the captain, lieutenant of the ship, and then you've got the people who are clearly scientists and how they were responding to something external. It started out like this is going to be okay.
It was fine, yeah.
Yeah. And then, I don't know when it turned, but yes. And
as soon as they stepped on the ship, the mysterious
I did not ship. Like. Dr. Reinhardt's character at all. And there were plenty of times where like his emotional reaction or non-reaction was wrong. It was just completely like when Durant is killed. Like, so right leading up to that, he says, Maximilian. And then that's when Maximilian goes to kill. Like, and you don't actually know that that's coming because it's like a slow approach. It's weird. And then they just stand there and everyone lets it happen. And then afterwards, you know, he's like, oh, well, he was a good guy. Like, Maximilian, why did you do that? But he's like flat. It was weird.
Very contrived because that robot was not a fast moving robot. No, Durant had every obviously the actor had not. He had to stand there and take it as an actor and portray being killed. But that thing was so slow moving. It was like, come on. Now, the actor did a fine job. Perkins did a fine job pretending his little blades were cutting into his chest or stomach or whatever, but it just
I don't have a complaint about that part, but I don't think I liked a single thing about Reinhardt's character because it was like up and down and not in the right, like, it was like he was missing beats all over the place.
Let me read to you what I wrote down.
Yes.
And I kind of disagree with you, Adina, because I said my two favorite characters are Dr. Reinhardt and Vincent, as you mentioned earlier. What I wrote is, Schell is the only character who has the fun of portraying two distinctly different characters, the mad scientist and the scientist interested in discovering the mystery of black holes. And who cannot love Roddy McDowall as the voice of Vincent? He had the best lines in the film, always saying quotes that best fit the situation, like you had mentioned, Adina. As for the true Disney characters, that has to be Bob, the old robot voiced by Slim Pickens. That corny old prospector-like robot that gives his life for the others. All the other characters to me were extremely wooden. I mean, really, you know, just, but Ernest Borgnine as the coward, he was there to be in total contrast to the two hero characters played by Forrester and I forget the other actor's name. And then as far as Maximilian
Joseph
the robot,
Bottoms.
Thank you, Timothy Bottoms. And as far as Maximilian the robot, he to me ends up as Emperor Zorg in this Toy Story movies.
Right.
That's true.
Yes. So, I mean, yeah, there wasn't that many actors and all the zombies, the zombie crew. Yeah. I mean, really, how stupid. And all the robots that they had that were bronze. I mean, they moved like wooden soldiers from a bad parade. It's there's just a lot of wrong here.
It was terrible. Chris, how do you think of the zombie robots, whatever?
So I thought the concept of the humans being turned to, I don't know what he specifically did. Like they lobotomized them, I think.
Yes. That's what
the only reason I know that part is because it said so on the Wikipedia page that I read afterwards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm on right now. And it was an interesting concept. I'm like, if you have a cool concept, one of the great things to do in any story is to build on that concept. Let's have a payoff. Let's explore it. But they didn't, they just kind of said, oh yeah, this is a little weird. And then they moved on. We just got to get out of here, which I get, but it's just like, they could have either find a way of incorporating that more into the story or just don't have that concept.
Well, we had enough issues with them having 18th century furniture in the dining room. How many people decide to put a zombie-o-matic on their spaceship? You know, you might not. Hey, you know something, Christ? We might need to turn all the crew into zombies. Let's put a zombie-o-meter in there or something, like whatever you call it, the zombie 2000,
whatever that lobotomizer thing was.
Yes. Not what you normally carry around as something to lobotomize your crew with.
Don't hold back, you guys. Jeez.
I want to know, was that technology launched with them or created in the couple decades that they were
created
out there?
And without a doubt.
But we don't. And the fact that they leave all these kinds of holes, they don't really answer their own questions.
Also, is this not in science fiction history? I'm going to go out on a big limb here.
Wow.
Is this not the worst use of massive amounts of space aboard these space stations that you've ever seen in film history? I mean, huge open. I mean, they're driving along in that car, that kind of, you know, elevator car thing. It is massive amounts of unused space.
I remember Discovery got busted.
Oh, yeah.
Season two for their turbo lifts and all the space in between. But I think that's just like a science fiction-y thing.
Yeah. As gorgeous as
Enterprise gets dinged quite a bit.
Right. In Strange New Worlds, the Enterprise is gorgeous, but it's just unrealistically big.
What a kitchen.
But it's unrealistically big.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, I feel like the TOS era Enterprise, even though it had that 60s look and whatever, in terms of space, how much space they all, that's a much more realistic evolution from current projections. But I don't think it's the first egregious use of space. And assuming you've got the material out there or whatever that's in everything, but there was some excuses for it. Like, and I can't believe I'm just trying to justify anything in this film, but
I love it.
The fact that they had that farm system, you know, to grow a lot of food. So you do, you know, in that version of it, you need a lot of space. So, you know, in reality, we're trying to, what yield can you get in the smallest space possible? But, you know, I think that kind of in some ways justifies some of the space that they had.
Well,
I don't know.
Okay. You've got a point, but even think, and I hate to say it, but a film like The Martian, the spacecraft that they travel to the Earth, to Mars and back again, is a massive spaceship with tremendous amount of room for only six people. So it also,
I don't remember.
No, they had a, like a whole gymnasium. They had a large meeting area. Their kitchen area was very large. It was very spacious. And of course, again, depending on the site, you're going to build this. Yeah. I mean, Adina, you would realize you would build the spaceship to fit the amount of people on board, right?
Well, right. But it's people on board. It's space for growing stuff. It's space for storage stuff. It's space for trash. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of things, you know, and how much space do you dual use? Like what we're doing these days for habitats that we might be designing in real life right now, we have the idea is to have fold away exercise equipment that then pops out, but then folds away. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you look at the International Space Station, which nominally only houses 3 to 6 people at a time, it's also technically there's a lot of space there. Now it's cluttered with all everything, but there is actually quite a different. Yeah, I'm looking back at the Martian spacecraft right now. And given the kind of movie it is and the things, it doesn't seem to be ridiculous to me.
Well, compared to this film, yes.
Oh, yeah. No, but I'm saying even just as a natural evolution of what I know in real life. And the reason why is because in real life, if we send a few astronauts out to Mars where they're alone for 6 months, mm-hmm. you know, they can't get other supplies from Earth. They have to have everything they need. They have to have spare parts. They have to have everything. This doesn't look crazy to me.
Okay, because it would be, you would think that the largest amount of space would be devoted to, as you say, storage, fuel, food, water, oxygen, replacement equipment, mm-hmm. all those things like that you would need. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, to this day, looking at the Apollo 11 or the Apollo capsules, and for three people to live in there as long as they did in the space that they were allotted, that's truly amazing. Okay. And to have a bathroom in there as well.
Yeah. Think of, you know, what we refer to with that is like, it's like a camping trip. You know, it's like a camping trip. And this is the terminology we use when we're thinking about designing stuff, habitation spaces for space. Mm-hmm. You know, are we camping or are we trying to provide more of like a hotel-like experience or even more something more permanent than that? So what the Apollo guys were doing, they were camping.
Yeah.
Okay. What we're trying to do now in real life is kind of evolve a little bit from the camping mentality to more of a hotel-y kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. But then even there, it takes the kind of resources that we have. And one of the reasons, you know, that you have a modular space station looks like it does is limitations on the size that we can launch, you know, because we're still developing expandables and inflatables and all these different things. So my point is, yes, it's amazing what they were able to do, but you know, they were only in those Apollo capsules for like, you know, all told like a week, just over a week. Yeah. And the space shuttle too was really amazingly little space for seven people, you know, 6 or 7 people, but also for up to 2 weeks. They're camping.
I mean, and you talk about camping.
Mars, yeah. Yeah. Sending folks to Mars, that is like again, 6 weeks. Without any way to get back to Earth, get resupplied from Earth, do anything. So you really have to have a lot more available to you.
And considering when you talk about camping, you look at the Gemini spacecraft with the two in there. I mean, literally, the only time they could stand up was when they opened up the hatch. So, I mean, that's you talk about cramped. That's cramped.
But that's again, it was a sign of what they were doing, the technology at the time and the needs, the time, which again, they're going around Earth a handful of times a day or so. You know, people can deal with that when they're studying, when this is a test, all that stuff. Very big difference between when we start thinking about going to Mars. So when I'm looking at this spacecraft, again, fictional spacecraft, but for the realistic, you know, scenario of the Martian, this definitely seems an evolution of what we know, our current technology and what our thinking could possibly be.
Okay. All right.
So
shall we move on to the next topic?
Sorry.
We're talking about the black hole, if you two
I know. Sorry about that, kid.
I want to
throw tangent alert, tangent
before
alert.
Before we... Chris and I should have our own separate conversation while you guys are, we'll mute and call each other and say, we don't know what they're talking about, but how about Star Trek, the motion
weekend,
picture?
Can I also remember this past weekend, I just came off of doing a presentation at a convention on space habitats. So I'm currently, it's all currently right in my brain. This is like the big conversation this weekend. So
go ahead, Chris.
the guy with the mustache, what's his name again? Because he had one of he had a great line where he's like, it's the taxpayers' dollars or something.
Ernest Borgnine. That's
Yes. I'm like, okay, that kind of is at least they're sort of addressing that right. It's so large, but you're right. It but I feel like most sci-fi is guilty of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I kind of felt like this ship was over the top extra space though.
Yeah, it was over the top.
And I will say this though. The bright shining part of this film, at least the first half of the film, is the music score.
I was going to say,
it's got a really intriguing opening.
Oh, they'll love it. I mean,
intriguing and different sounding. But once all the action started, it just got cheesy and it was like, what are you guys doing? So we talked about a couple things. What do you guys think of? Are there any good things about the cinematography, special effects, costumes, sets, all that? So we've kind of talked about sets
Can
already.
Can I talk about the score?
Yeah,
we haven't acknowledged that this is
Chris,
John
Barry.
Chris,
you and I we're going to take over this portion of the podcast right now.
This is John Barry.
Dean and I are going to twiddle our thumbs. Okay, let's twiddle.
I was so excited when I saw this is John Barry. I'm like, James Bond? And then you hear it and I'm like, this sounds like James Bond. This is like, it's funny because if we're talking about the size of the ship, I'm like, this does, when you have a John Barry score, it feels more like you're almost dealing with a Bond villain than like in a sci-fi movie. So I like the score a lot. That was definitely the standout. I like the first half of the, what do you call it? Not the intermission, the interlude. The opening overture.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which is when the original theater release had the overture where you'd sit in the theater for quite
about halfway through. I'm like, okay, let me just skip. I need to get to the start of this film. But score for me was definitely probably the strongest aspect of the movie.
I agree 100%, my friend.
100%. The only portion of the score that just bothers me is when they're having the shootout.
Yes.
And it just, they recycle the same piece of music two or three times in a row. And
it wasn't nuanced.
Yes. And it was just too much. That was, but you're right. The opening sequence, when they open up and you hear that music, melodic pulse. It's good. It draws you right into the movie.
Yeah. And I really feel like we're answering all of these questions kind of all at once tonight as we record this. So
you're right.
I'm going to go head on to number five here. Anyone keeping score, and I think I know the answer. Does this film hold up, or does it look like it was made in 79 or
earlier? A lot earlier. I'm trying to appreciate what Disney, was doing back in the late 70s, because, this is a couple of years after Star Wars.
Yeah. Right.
And this looks like a decade earlier than Star Wars, And of course, again, there's different companies involved. So I'm trying to remember. And these days we think of Disney as fairly on top of the everything. So I don't remember, back then what their live action was known for, but this was not. A decade or earlier, just in color.
The prior Disney action films were the Computer Wore Tennis Shoes and the Apple Dumpling Gang and Flubber,
cute. I like Flubber a lot.
Flubber's one. Well, yes, of course, Fred McMurray. But, I was looking about the film and this film cost Disney $20 million, which at that time was a record. But comparison.
Was it really?
Yes, but in comparison, Star Trek, the motion picture, that cost $44 million to make.
Oh, wow.
Star Wars cost $18 million. So you're looking like, who got more bang for their buck? Did Star Wars get more for their $18 million than did Disney? The answer is yes.
Yeah, Star Wars got more.
Yeah, without a doubt.
To a degree.
But then we mentioned earlier about the comparison to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which this kind of has that same feel of it, the mad scientist who wants to do good and so on. That movie in 1954 cost $9 million. At that point, the most expensive movie ever made.
But you just said 1954, right?
1950. Mm-hmm. So
that's a good 25 years earlier.
What year was 20,000 Leagues made?
1954.
When, oh, Adina, do me a favor. Look up when Ben-Hur was made.
Okay.
What was the previous most expensive film before 20,000? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So,
okay.
But so again,
budget $15.2 million.
Wow. Okay.
Wow. In 1959?
Yep.
Wow, according to Wikipedia. Wow, right. That's a lot of money.
And always reliable, never wrong.
We have to mention the other big movie that was mentioned in our group chat. 2001. Mm-hmm. That was made in what, 1968?
19, yep. And I didn't look up how much that one cost, 2001.
But 10.5. Look how good that movie looks.
10.5 million. Okay, right. So that, considering the sets too, and everything of that, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, you think, too, though, we're talking innovators in their field for Star Wars, for 2001.
Yeah.
They were innovating things. I don't think Disney was an innovator though in cartoons, animation, mm-hmm. stuff
in
like
animation.
That.
Animation.
Right.
Not with
so
live action at that point.
It was like they made this film and they didn't innovate with it. They should have tried to innovate something new, and because I honestly, like, at the beginning of the film, I thought it looked pretty good with all the digital effects and CGI stuff. And then even, you know, some of this, like the exterior shots really weren't terrible. They weren't mm-hmm. the best.
They were serviceable. But, they did their job.
But yeah, but I just, as the film went on, it was just like, oh my God, especially with the matte paintings, interior shots of the ship.
So now you
talk
about
all of that. With a better script.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
He had a better
Amen.
Script.
Yeah.
But here's the thing.
Dialogue.
You mentioned about Disney's innovation. 3 years later, 1982 comes out. What's this movie? Tron.
Oh.
Tron. Talk about innovation. Talk about.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, making groundbreaking computer animated, computer enhanced film, all about computers. And the funny thing was, right after we were done watching The Black Hole, Elaine turns to me, she goes, you know what? I want to watch, let's watch Tron, just as a comparison. And you could just see how Tron was Disney at its best in coming up with something completely out of the box.
I wonder if somewhere along the way, someone said, you know, The Black Hole was a missed opportunity. What can we do to...
Well,
push the envelope.
According to Wikipedia, they were in 2009 considering a remake, but eventually it did get axed.
Of The Black Hole.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
But it's Nick, you know.
Right,
next.
Right. Yeah. So
then they made John Carter, right?
I'll say this, the cover's really
what's,
cool.
What's, how about that ending? Could anyone make heads? I've got thoughts, but I'm going to go last because I'm hosting this week.
Sorry about that, kids.
How about that ending? What do you guys, can you make heads or tails of it?
Are they meant to be in heaven and hell? Is that like the punchline?
Hey, kids, like, let's have a metaphor right here, okay? Because we don't know what the hell to do with the end of this film.
Literally.
I mean, come on. You know, it's like, okay, they're floating in space. There's evil Dr. Reinhardt and Maximilian. All of a sudden, they're meld together, and you can see his eyes through the hole.
Right.
Really? Come on, kids.
Thoughts?
Well,
come on, more
that
thoughts?
That would mean that robots go to heaven, too.
No, they go to hell.
They were in hell.
Wait, no. Vincent. I'm talking about Vincent.
Oh, Vincent. Well, yeah, that's true. No, yeah. Okay. Well, then that we can make a new movie called All Good Robots Go to Heaven. We'll make a new version.
That's a good film.
I have better luck describing and parsing out the ending of 2001 than this. I have no idea what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
It's good, Chris.
What's so brilliant about 2001's ending is people are still debating it. Like, I have been trying to figure this out for a long time. Fans have. I think there's even, like, TikTok videos where Stanley Kubrick has, like, sort of explained it. And even then, people, there's still so many questions. But there's questions with this one, but it's not the same. It's not like it's a brilliant, like, what does it actually mean? It's just like, okay.
Right. After this podcast, I'm never thinking about it again.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, wait, that's not true. You'll think about it when we produce the episode and get it out and have to tell people about it.
Yeah. What have I done?
Didn't Neil deGrasse Tyson say that if you were to enter a black hole, you would be elongated like spaghetti? I mean, I don't know where I heard of that nature of what would happen to you.
Watch the other black hole movie. That's really good.
Event Horizon?
I was going to say Interstellar, even though I wouldn't call it a black hole movie. But
okay.
No. So the reality is we don't have any direct measurement experiments. So anything that anyone wants to say about what would happen as you approach the black hole is all, you know, some theoretical speculation. But but yes, what DeGrasse Tyson is saying about that is true. So really, at the end of the day, you know, we know, okay, the Earth has some mass and we feel, you know, we live in what we call 1G, one gravity. We know if you look at the sun, there's a lot more mass. So assuming, forget the temperature for a second, assuming you could stand on the surface, you'd be crushed because you'd be pulled in the weight. Now, just consider more mass, not larger, but more massive and massive and massive. So everything, you know, you feel that gravity more and more and more and more and more. At some point, it crosses the limit to where nothing could eventually, like nothing can at least mathematically be predicted to come out. And so light is also affected by gravity. So even light gets pulled in, which is why we call it, you know, the term is a black hole. And again, in a lot of science, things get named and sometimes the names are unfortunate, but that's just what it is. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's like as much mass as you could possibly have, you know, like mathematically predict squeezed into a spot to that and nothing comes out. So yes, because if you have something, you know, the Earth is actually pulling on your feet more than it's pulling on your head. You just don't feel it because we were built to survive this environment. On the sun, on Jupiter, you might actually start feeling it. So the more mass, then you'll feel that more. So yes, DeGrasse Tyson is not wrong about this.
Okay, so that's, I did hear correct about that. But, and again, and then designing a spaceship that has an anti-gravity device.
That's all fiction, fiction, fiction.
I know,
fiction,
it's just fiction, like, fiction. It's just like, really? Really? Okay.
But that's, we accept, I'm okay with that too in this movie. As much as I'm okay with just the fact that the Enterprise, you know, just has some kind of magical anti-grav system. So they seem to be in just, you know, and I'm okay for the purposes of when we watch Star Wars, when we watch Star Trek, and a lot of it is we accept it because honestly, it's easier to film. It's easier to produce. If they had to worry about gravity, it would just be a much more expensive thing. So let's just, they've got some magic technology because it's a future or, you know, galaxy far, far away, a long time ago. And that's fine.
And, but you and know interestingly enough, I read that they originally were going to try to film this whole film without gravity. And they were, and so as they started filming, you'll notice the opening scene, they're all floating
in the Palomino.
They realized what a pain in the butt that was going to be and how long it would take and expensive, all that stuff. So that's when they actually wrote in, hey, we need this anti-grav whatever thing to, so that we can
But at least in modern films, we do have devices, spacecraft that produce a gravity by centrifugal force. That's in 2001, that was in The Martian and other films where you do have a rotating portion to create an artificial gravity.
Yeah, and we have to be, and again, people have to be very careful because it is, what they're still doing, they're still taking some leaps in doing that in film. And it is still, these are, we're talking about films that also, again, do have a big budget too. You know, The Martian was not a small budget film. So it's still expensive to film it. And so I get, even in Star Trek, which has big budgets, I really get it's a convenience thing if you're in a situation where you can manufacture tech, you know, just invent yourself some technology just to get around production costs. I have no problem. I'm as long as you're self-consistent and within your story and your universe, I'm okay. You know, it works. It's okay.
And their ships can stop in space, like dead stop, like not even floating a little bit.
That's okay
Isn't
too.
That impossible to.
No. So it depends on where you are, and depends on what you. It depends on where you are, and depends on what you mean by stop. You know, if you are truly in between stars. You know, if you're moving and you apply a thrust the other way, you can stop relative to anything you can do. If you're in orbit, no, you don't just stop. You're moving with respect to something. What is that something? Mm-hmm. And to some perspective, like a geosynchronous spacecraft, from a certain point of view, looks like it is hovering over the Earth, surface of the Earth. It's not. It just happens to be rotating at the same rate as the Earth is rotating. Mm-hmm. So it is all a matter of your frame of reference and such, too.
Okay. I was just thinking more like the times they just say, come, like, enter all, like, you know, take us a full stop, and then they just stop, and then they...
Usually that's when they're not in orbit around it. They're, like, in between the gravitational bodies.
Right, doing their thing.
Yeah.
But you could actually have an opposite force applied to against a gravitational body to encounter a stop, if you a full stop.
Well, again, if you're in orbit, no. If you're away from orbit, like, yes. Mm-hmm. Unless you're doing some other magical technology to, you know, be not in orbit yet just be there.
Welcome to Physics Class 101 with the Big Sci-Fi Podcast.
Take it all back.
I think, like, it's like, okay, you can complain about the gravitational field or whatever they had, but I feel like, okay, that's fine. Again, it would, like, I think all those things would be forgiven if it was a better film. Yes. I enjoyed it because it was terrible, but if it was actually a good film, I think you could get past... a lot of those things.
I appreciate you saying that.
Can we have that sewed on a pillow? I like this film. No, what'd you say? This film is bad, even though I liked it. What was those exact words? I like that. I think we should.
I liked it because it's like the movie The Room with Tommy Wiseau, where it's so bad that it's so enjoyable.
Oh, hi, Chris. Oh, hi, Steve. Oh, hi, Chris.
Yeah.
So, right. No idea what you guys are talking about. So,
okay, you got to bring this back. Bring us back, Brian.
Guys, I just apologize for asking you to watch this film. I thought it was going to be much better than it was. So, for me, the ending of the film, I feel like they just didn't, like, how did they wrap this up? They threw in some action. They threw in some special effects of them getting sucked into the wormhole. It's almost like they tried to do a little 2001-y trippy thing. And then next thing we know, this guy is apparently in Hades, in hell, and the robot Maximilian's there, and they come together in a very awkward moment, and he's inside the robot all of a sudden. And so what are they saying there? Are they saying he and the robot were the same? This is his judgment for being so, really, frankly, playing God with everybody on the ship and with his desire to kind of, you know, trump everybody's needs below his own desire to find out what a black hole's all about. So very strange and bizarre. Guys, two more questions, and then I can alleviate your pain and your torment this evening. Is this film worth watching as a point of interest for the discerning science fiction fan, or should we tell people, don't waste your time?
I don't think so. Unless you really want to make a film, it's always good to watch the bad ones too. But I'd say if you're just looking for something fun to watch and you're a sci-fi fan, probably not.
Okay.
Okay. What I wrote is, yes, you should watch this. This is a unique science fiction film that should be seen. You might not like it, but it is part of a series of science fiction films that we've reviewed and seen that may not be great, but we still watch them because we should, including Moonfall. Though cheesy films like this and cheesy films like Star Wars are films that we should see because they represent what was coming out in the late 70s in films, and these only led to better films that came from them. We learned
how to make better movies. You got to clarify.
Chris and I are both aghast.
We are aghast, and I don't ever use that term.
Perplexed,
dismayed,
perplexed.
Hey, if Star Trek the Motion Picture wasn't so ponderous, and comparing it to Wrath of Khan, that makes Wrath of Khan seem like, whoa, that's great compared to. So, yeah, you know, they do lead to better films. They do lead to better films.
So I'm going to say, and I think I'm one of the ones who I'm fairly forgiving in the sense that even if the movie is not necessarily even could be a little difficult to watch, usually I'm like, well, if you want that full round, you know, well-rounded sci-fi education, I'm usually the person to say, yes, go watch the film. In this case, I'm like, this, there's nothing about here that you need that will round out your sci-fi education. Absolutely not. if you want a Disney film from that era, and this is one we should probably cover, because this is one I feel like I do have a reasonable memory of, you know, Escape from Witch Mountain.
I've been wanting to watch that one too.
Yeah. If you're looking for like that Disney fix, with a sci-fi way, that one, and it's from a little later, what is it? Flight of the Navigator.
That was also recommended.
So I feel like there are other movies that will be more worth your time, way more worth your time. And of course, Tron, that, mm-hmm. you know, a part of that, again, they're going to be 70s, 80s films. So expect them to be 70s, 80s films, but that definitely have much more. There's still something more there. This is just
It falls totally flat.
I was gonna say maybe our tagline is we watch these films so you don't have to.
In this case, yes.
Yes.
You know, go ahead, Chris.
Two final thoughts. One, let's make it very clear that we are not saying that Star Wars is a bad movie. We do not want to compare it to the Black Hole and say,
no. No one said Star Wars is a bad movie.
Steve called it cheesy.
It is cheesy. You call it
it's cheesy. It has cheesy.
I'm sorry, but they even said, the actors even said while they were going, really? This script? These I've words? We're supposed to say these things?
Steve, I've never disagreed cheesy, with you
but
more.
But that's okay. No, I love Star Wars. It's a great film. It started something. But it is a cheesy movie.
I wouldn't know. I feel like maybe we need to spend an episode discussing the meaning
that's
of cheesy.
Episode. Mm-hmm. And the second point I want to make, it also recommended, or not recommended, but there's another movie that Disney Plus related it to, with a certain Joey Tribbiani in space, which I feel like
Lost
we should check out. Does this ring a bell? Anybody? Lost in Space.
That was like the redo from like 2010 or something. We're talking about 1980 stuff.
Oh, this one.
But
I
it
was
recommended
just saying, 1999.
That's all he's saying.
I'm just saying it was related. When you go on the related.
1999. Page. It was that long ago.
Yeah. Yeah,
It was. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't think it was that long ago.
Who was it? Hurt is in that film.
Yeah, William Hurt.
William Hurt. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah,
and Joey Tribbiani.
My goodness.
Oh yeah,
As a humongous Friends fan, and I saw that movie in the theater, being a humongous Friends fan and anxious to see Matt LeBlanc and other things, and I'm a big sci-fi fan. That was not my favorite movie either. But I don't think I would say I wouldn't watch it again.
I would watch that again just to see if I remember it correctly. I'm gonna say, guys, this film falls so flat. I appreciate everyone's appreciation of it on some level or lack of any appreciation for it. I'm gonna say, and Steve, man, I feel so bad. My heart hurts that I disagree with you so much about cheesy Star Wars and about people watching this. I say avoid this at all costs. It is not worth the time. Go buy the soundtrack. Or better yet, don't spend money on it. Just find it on Spotify or YouTube or something and listen to the soundtrack. It's interesting. So, guys, let's not waste any more time here. I feel like Adina's like just ready to sign off at any moment. And guys, we need to care for Adina's mental health tonight, okay? So what on a scale of 1 to 5, okay, the Brian Donahue classic rating system, Steve calls it, what would you rate this film? We'll start with a resident nice guy, and I want to make sure I point out he's so nice. I'm so sad I disagree with you tonight. But what would you rate this film? 1 to 5 stars or less than one? Even.
No, I have to give it something, and
okay,
I'm going to give it 1.5 because it is worth watching just for the understanding of what the film was. But I wouldn't really on my own now go back and watch it again. I've seen it. I'm done.
Right.
That's fine.
Right.
But I would not say don't watch this. I would not say, I would say do watch it. Just be ready for what you're going to see.
Right. Chris.
So I'm using the IGN scale, which means nothing, but I always, this is how I rate my movies. Because one is just like awful, unbearable. Don't even bother with it. To me, this is a 4 or 5. Like, not good. Really not good. But
no,
four,
no.
Four or five, one you're saying it's not good?
Rating.
Wait a minute. Wait
one
a minute.
To five rating.
Four or
not
five,
one
that's
to ten.
Good.
Out of 10. That's a 40%.
No, no, no. One to five. One to five.
Oh, okay. Well, then.
Oh, 1 to 5.
Yeah, one to five.
Well, you're more like 2.5. You're around 2.5 then.
We're all, if you guys could have seen the eyebrows raise when Chris said a 4 or 5, it was
just one of the
I was thinking that Chris has got some Disney stock he needs to go up, so he wants to make a little more money or something.
Right. So, okay, Chris.
I have to call
from 1 to 5 stars. Yeah. 1 to 5 stars.
Yeah, one. You know, I'm going to say a 2.
Okay. Okay.
2's good.
That's fair.
Yep.
Adina?
I'm also in about the 1.5 category where at least a half or more goes to Vincent alone.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Vincent was the saving grace.
Hey, in that we can all agree, I think, tonight. That makes my heart warm. I'm going to give this a 1 as well.
Okay.
And I feel like I'm giving it a 1 because of 3 factors. The music score, Ernest Borgnine, who I loved in McHale's Navy, grew up watching McHale's Navy, the television show. So I've got a warm spot for Mr. Borgnine in my heart. And Vincent. I wanted to like it because of Dr. Reinhardt, that actor. I've seen Judgment at Nuremberg several times, which stars our own William Shatner as well, Spencer Tracy. Just incredibly well done film. But it's so disappointing that this role could have been much. He could have been the movie. His character could have been the movie. It could have been a shining light in the film, and it wasn't. So for that, I give it a 1. And any final thoughts before I sign off tonight? No,
nope.
Ladies and gentlemen, watch Goldfinger.
That's it.
Chris
watch
says. Okay.
If you really want to enjoy the soundtrack of this movie, just watch Goldfinger.
Okay.
That's it.
Cool. And I will say this. I will. My final thought is I will probably watch Moonfall before I watch this film again.
Whoa.
So.
Whoa.
Starship Troopers, folks. Never Starship Troopers. Just
or
for
even
the
RoboCop.
RoboCop. Oh my God.
We're bringing up all of. Oh, poor Brian. He's going to go for PTSD movie PTSD from all this.
There's good stuff. Let's talk about the good stuff.
All right. Well, folks, I apologize once again for asking my really good friends to watch the film The Black Hole. I had no idea how terrible it was. I thought it looked pretty good and intriguing, and it was intriguing at least for the first half of the film, but then it all just went patooey all over the television, and I just had to watch it because after all, I picked this episode in this film to watch. So how do you guys feel about it? Would you let us know? We are serious when we say, please email us. Get on Facebook. Join our Facebook group. It's on Facebook, by the way, in case you were confused there. And it's on Facebook. Our Facebook group is on Facebook.
In Yiddish, it's Put'em Book. It's Put'em Book.
Follow us on Instagram or X, formerly known as Twitter, where you can keep up to date on all things big sci-fi, interact with us, and yes, it's really us commenting and liking things, not our agents. Do you guys have agents?
I don't have an agent.
Man.
I have a couple kids.
Hey, that counts. Okay. Also, don't forget to check out all the other podcasts on the Trek Geeks Podcast Network and sign up for Trek Long Island in May before it's too late. We really want to meet you and hang out and talk about, well, Star Trek, but really anything. We'd love just to get to know you and what are you interested in. We're going to be on panels. We're going to do trivia on the main stage. It's going to be fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
See what I did there? Fantastic. Yes. Lots of fans will be there. Anyways, remember, we're on this trek together, folks. So be nice to each other. And we'll see you on the flip side of the next episode of the Big Sci-Fi Podcast.
Coconut!